Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Donna Grigsby Show because our special guest from the University of Kentucky, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Chief of the Division of General Academic Pediatrics, is Dr. Donna Grigsby. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Thank you.
Our special thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. My co-medical host, the UK service owner for telephony, Rick Phillips, is on assignment in Isonville. So he will be coming back next week. Our website to listen to the show is WMKY.org. It's a new website. Our archives have been pruned, but there are still a few very high-quality shows there. Our research on HM Radio Show on Facebook. Go there, like us, take a look at what we've posted in the past week. Our sponsor for today's show, sleep. The best cure for insomnia is to get a lot of sleep, says W.C. Fields. Now, I will tell you, Donna, I thought this will be very simple. I'll just go to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'll get their recommendations on sleep. And I found it was kind of tricky. Can you tell us, in your practice, how do you approach sleep? Is this something that you only talk about when there's a problem, or do you actually ask that in the well child visit?
That's actually part of the information that we get in a well child visit, even starting very early in the newborn period. And it's because it is so important to the well-being of children for them to sleep properly. And the reason that it's hard to get that information from the AAP is because in children, the amount of sleep needed varies from year to year, from month to month. So it's very difficult to see something concrete about, okay, my child is, I mean, you can find this, but my child is X age, and this is how much sleep they need to get. And you actually can find those charts, but they're not easy to find.
It seems like pretty much throughout the ages, what we all know is that we should be getting more sleep.
Absolutely. And that's true for children and adults as well. I think the biggest problem that we see in children getting improper sleep is that we are so overscheduled. We have so many activities scheduled as a family, as an individual child, as a parent, that it's difficult to get into that very important routine in getting to bed every night at a certain time, awakening every day at a certain time. School forces us to do that, or work forces us to do that, but we have so many demands on our time that I do think our children don't get the proper amount of sleep.
That's our sponsor, sleep. Remember, according to W.C. Fields, the best cure for insomnia is to get a lot of sleep. We start off our show usually just talking about how a person got where that person is. And I'm very interested. First of all, you were not born and raised in the state of Kentucky.
I was not. I guess I am a transplant Kentuckian now, huh? I actually was born and raised in Tennessee, which gets me into a little trouble here from time to time. But I grew up in Knoxville and went to school at the University of Tennessee, which really gets me into trouble here from time to time. I went to medical school in Tennessee and then actually came to Kentucky as a pediatric resident after medical school. So I've been here since 1986. So if you do the math, I was 2 when I got here.
Absolutely. You know, I actually was born in the western part of Kentucky, but left the state for good also on graduation of high school. Mm-hmm. And I did spend time at Vanderbilt. We loved East Tennessee. I planned to live there until time and events changed. When you were growing up in East Tennessee, mm-hmm. what was it that made you consider medicine as a profession?
I look back at that. I loved science, and I grew up thinking I wanted to do something to help someone. And I had an experience as a child. I laugh because I'm a pediatrician, but I really didn't like going to the pediatrician. I liked my pediatrician, but my pediatrician was associated with shots, and I hated shots. I actually was one of those children that had problems with their vision and ended up going to a pediatric ophthalmologist at a very young age. I started wearing glasses when I was 3 and had patches and treatment for that. And I absolutely loved my pediatric ophthalmologist. And originally, that's what I thought I wanted to be, was I wanted to be a pediatric eye doctor. But I always knew I wanted to work with children. You know, as a teenager and adult, I knew I wanted to work with children.
You know, I'm not convinced that a child was something wrong with them loves their doctor. You know, you're right. Mm-hmm. There are simply too many bad things associated mm-hmm. with going to the doctor for the child to love the doctor. I can understand the ophthalmologist because mm-hmm. there are very few shots, not a lot of pain. And I thought getting eyeglasses was pretty cool myself, so I can understand that.
Right. I had those great gold speckly cat eye glasses as a child. Very fabulous, yes.
Well, unfortunately, you know, we are a product of the same era, so I know.
You're 29, too. Yes.
I know far too much about what you're talking about. Uh-huh. So you had this dream. You thought something like the pediatric ophthalmology. Uh-huh. Now, that's based on your experience. I understand that.
Yes.
You would think those were the people that you saw. Did that influence then your choice of college at UT, or the studies that you took, or were you sort of bent toward science anyway?
I was always bent toward science. I loved science. So I knew that going in, I decided probably when I was a junior in high school that I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up. And it was just because I loved science and I really wanted to do something to help people. So that's why I decided to be a doctor.
Medical school at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City and
yes.
Tri-Cities area.
Yes.
By the way, a beautiful area. I really, really like Northeast Tennessee. And I'm sorry
yes.
for our Kentucky fans. Not a bad place. If you're from out of the area, you should really go visit there. Some excellent hiking. The wilderness there is just wonderful. The towns are very nice and picturesque as well. Then on to residency at Lexington. What attracted
yes.
you to the University of Kentucky as a resident?
It was actually highly recommended by my chair of pediatrics where I went to medical school. I went to a fairly young medical school at that time. It's still, I think I was in the fifth or sixth graduating class. And so my chair of pediatrics, who I respected, sent me to Lexington and said, this is definitely a place you need to visit. They're very strong clinically. I thought I wanted to be a general pediatrician. I didn't want to be a specialist. And he felt like I would get a great education here. And I looked at a lot of different places, but this was actually my first choice for residencies.
Now, the differences between, again, for people from outside mm-hmm. the region, they'd say, oh, Tennessee, it's the same stuff. Tennessee, Kentucky, mm-hmm. there's no mm-hmm. different. But there are some significant differences between living in Lexington and living in the Knoxville area. I'll give you one. Again, mm-hmm. I live in the Nashville area. In the wintertime, we would drive around in our cars. We would leave for the mm-hmm. weekend. We mm-hmm. would not check the weather report to
right.
see whether we would actually be able
right.
to make it back. Winters in Lexington, there's always that chance of a paralyzing snow.
Right.
There is a lot of mud in the wintertime
yes.
here, and I think more gray skies. Did you notice other differences in moving to Lexington, or was this a pretty easy move for you?
It was pretty easy. I think folks are very similar. I think people are warm and friendly in both places. And the biggest difference I noticed was the water. You know, in Knoxville, there's a river that goes right through the city. And you're surrounded by mountains. And so to me, that was the biggest difference, was that I went from a place where being on the river was a very much a part of the culture and going to the mountains all the time for fun and relaxation. And then coming to a place that was beautiful in its own way with rolling hills. And I actually thought it wasn't much of a challenge to drive here in the snow, because when it snows in Knoxville, you have to negotiate some pretty significant hills. And so it's pretty flat here, I thought. So I was kind of surprised that it could be so paralyzing for it to snow.
And for our northern listeners, when you get down that far south, a half inch of snow absolutely shuts down the city. It becomes very difficult. Now, you finished your residency, and then what attracted you to academic pediatrics as opposed to going into a pediatric practice?
You know, I stayed on and did a chief year, which was kind of an academic teaching and additional patient care year. I absolutely love what I do today. I loved the field of pediatrics. I loved what I was doing. And I wanted to be someone that could show that to young physicians, to medical students. I had role models in the field that I felt showed me the right way to do things and taught me how to put patients first and how to put families first. And I felt like it was important for the young students and residents to see someone that had that level of commitment, that recognized how important it was to take good care of patients and families. So that was one of the reasons why I wanted to stay, and I enjoyed teaching. The other thing I wanted to be growing up was a teacher, not a medical school teacher, but certainly I saw myself as a teacher. So this career has afforded me both opportunities.
Last November, awarded one of the best doctors in America. That is a top 5% of physicians, according to their peers. And congratulations on
Thank
that.
You. Thank you. That
was a surprise, or because it would be hard to anticipate that.
It's an award. I even get kind of choked up talking about it. It is a wonderful honor, I think, to be recognized by your peers. So I've received that honor before, and it is humbling to me, actually, I think, to have your peers regard you like that. So it to me is a great honor.
Special interest, clinical interest in childhood obesity and adult obesity. I take care of some of that, and obviously we've got a lot. We go by the body mass index, the BMI. Mm-hmm. That's your age in radians divided by the moon squared, and everybody can calculate it on their own. But with kids,
right,
you're running percentiles, right? Are you still, you do that? And
yes.
I always wondered about that because as the kids get bigger, right. I mean, what you say is, well, everyone's getting bigger, but your child, please, ma'am, you've got to get some control. How do you judge when a child is obese?
We still do the BMI calculations for children, and when you look at growth curves, there's a curve for height and weight, there's a growth curve for head circumference, and there's a growth curve for BMI. So we do recognize it as a problem in children that we're seeing more and more frequently now. But we look at the BMI, and if you're above the 95th percentile in BMI for someone your age, then we talk to the families about not necessarily putting their child on a diet, but adjusting their lifestyles. And many times it's a matter of increasing their activities rather than sitting in the house, you know, behind the screen or playing video games all day long. Get outside and play. Run and play with your friends or be active. If you don't live in a place that's where it's safe to be outside, sign up for some activities, go to the park, walk as a family. Activity seems to be a really important factor in obesity in children, and just good food choices. I don't want people starving their children. And I recognize that part of childhood is doing fun things like going to somebody's birthday party and eating a piece of cake or eating some ice cream. And that's all part of childhood. But it's making those good food choices on a day-to-day basis that I think make the difference.
Why don't you make a good food choice now? Go to the refrigerator, get a healthy snack, sit down, take a break. We're going to take a break ourselves and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I am Dr. Tony Weaver. With me, I guess the show's namesake, from the University of Kentucky, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Chief of the Division of General Academic Pediatrics, Dr. Donna Grigsby. Hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, and thanks for coming back for a second fractional portion. Some of our guests just leave. You never know. Oh, and I should, for those guests who are listening, my granddaughter is now 2 weeks old, still no scholarships, still no product endorsements. I am as mystified as you are what's going on there. But that's where the granddaughter stands. We'll try to give you an update throughout the show if something does come up. Our sponsor for the second time, sleep. Remember, the best cure for insomnia is to get a lot of sleep, according to W.C. Fields. And I've got a couple of things, Donna, I just wanted to ask you about. First of all, I saw this, and I believe this represents American Academy of Pediatrics thinking, between birth and 6 months, children need 16 to 20 hours of sleep a day.
Yes, that's true. And the younger they are, the more sleep they need.
So if you have a newborn, such as I have, this baby wakes up, again, sleeps 20 hours out of 24. Mm-hmm. So actually having an awake baby that is not crying is virtually impossible. I mean, he basically wakes up, feeds, sleeps, right?
That's their job, right, because they're growing so quickly. And children do a lot of growth while they're asleep. That's why one of the other reasons why sleep is so important. But, yeah, they'll wake up, they'll feed, they'll go right back to sleep, sometimes during the feed, and then they're back off to sleep.
Ages 11 to 12, around 10 hours, and teenagers about 9 hours of sleep a night. Not happening in the Weaver household when we had our teenage kids. That was simply impossible. I remember one time, you always, as a parent, you always think, oh, finally the child is sleeping through the night. Now, from here on out, I've got it made. And I remember specifically, our son was at a basketball game, got back at it was an away game, got back at 11:30 or midnight. Our daughter had to get up at 4 a.m. She's going with the band to some band festival. Mm-hmm. And I realized parents never sleep through the night. It just doesn't happen with all the events that they've got. So, again, we're back to talking about sleep. I pulled this also out of the American Academy of Pediatrics. They have something called BEARS, which you use for your sleep history. B is bedtime problems. You have problems falling asleep. E, excessive daytime sleepiness. And I don't know any teenage boy that doesn't have excessive daytime sleepiness. I just say that.
Well, and again, it should point you to sleep problems at night. Children who have sleep apnea will frequently have excessive sleepiness during the day. And so that's a bit of a red flag in terms of what kind of history you need to get about the sleep.
And that brings to A, awakenings during the night. And again, there are some conditions then that would prompt the child to wake up. I will tell you, my kids would sleep through an air raid. They awakenings were not, as a matter of fact, awakenings in the morning turns out to be a pretty big issue around our house. R of BEARS is regularity and duration of sleep. What time do you go to bed on nights, weekends? Regularity important. And S is sleep disorder, breathing, and especially snoring loudly at night is part of the sleep history. So how do you approach, again, we've talked about with the teenagers particularly, how do you approach your questioning on their sleep habits?
You know, it's interesting. In our county, locally, several years ago, they changed the start time for middle schoolers because they recognized that the middle schoolers particularly were not getting as much sleep as they needed to. So they actually moved their start time to like 9 or 9:15. You know, it's very early for the young ones. You know, when I talk to parents about sleep and I talk to teenagers about sleeping, I talk to them about some of the more common things that I see that interfere with sleep. So one thing that's really common is the television, computer, other electronic devices in the room where they sleep. And it seems to be very difficult for someone to go to sleep and watch TV at the same time. It's too stimulating, or the video games. They want to stay up half the night playing video games. And now they can play video games with their friends via the internet. So it's not that your child is alone in their room anymore. They're alone in the room with all of their buddies across town. So I talked to them a little bit about the importance of sleep, particularly for those that are still growing a lot. You know, teenagers still grow a lot, particularly teenage boys. They need a little more sleep because they're still growing, some up until they're, you know, 21 years old. So we talk a lot about bedtime routines and watching your caffeine intake and watching your sugar intake and making the house dark and quiet and peaceful when it's time to go to sleep and taking the TVs out of the room, taking computers out of the room into a common place. And there are more reasons to do that than just sleep. As a parent, it's difficult to monitor what your child is seeing and what your child is participating in if everything is locked up in their room. So I think it's really important for a lot of good reasons to have computers, TVs in common areas, not in their bedrooms. Bedrooms should be where you get dressed and where you sleep. How's that?
A very nice piece of advice, one that we at Health Matters have emphasized again, everything from our Christmas gifts of death all the way to now our discussion with a pediatrician. A TV set in the bedroom, generally a bad idea, generally associated with a lot of problems growing up. Much better to keep those in a common area if you can. That is our sponsor, Sleep, the Best Cure for Insomnia is to Get a Lot of Sleep. We'll visit that again in our third and final fractional portion. Now, the thing that got me interested in your writings, and Dr. Grigsby writes regularly for the Lexington Herald Leader, as well as her academic work, was on March 10th, and you made the statement, this was the way the article started, water and low-fat milk should be the drinks of choice, especially for children and adolescents. Soft drinks, limited if consumed at all, and energy drinks, not regulated by the FDA, that's true, and largely unstudied in children and teens. You were worried about these energy drinks.
Absolutely. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is worried about energy drinks and soda intake and juice intake and things like that. So those are directly the recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics, that children drink water and low-fat milk, preferentially, to any other fluid.
Did you see in your practice problems that you could attribute to energy drinks, or is this a concern just overall?
Certainly, we've seen problems in children in our practice, but nationally, there's been a real awareness that there are some children who have had significant cardiovascular issues, heart arrhythmias, problems with blood pressure, because of excessive caffeine intake. And caffeine sometimes can be disguised in other products. Like there is a natural occurring product called guarana. It is 40 times more potent than caffeine, and it's in a lot of energy drinks or even some vitamin waters. I discovered as a parent, I was appalled to realize that I was giving my child something. I thought it was a pretty healthy thing, but when I looked closely at the label, I realized that it had large amounts of caffeine and guarana. And so I fell victim to thinking this is something healthy when it actually was something that could have been potentially harmful to him.
Now, again, caffeine, to echo what you said, caffeine is now in a lot of products. We are Yes. very much a caffeinated society. Wrigley's had a caffeinated chewing gum. Mm-hmm. I think they've held up on that till the FDA makes some rulings. There are caffeinated jelly beans, caffeinated waffles that you can get for breakfast now, caffeinated mineral water. Certainly these drinks are mm-hmm. caffeinated as well. And, of course, we all know about soft drinks. The thing about soft drinks, they generally have 35 to 45 milligrams caffeine right. per 12 ounces. They cannot have more than 65 according to FDA regulations. And so we know that. These drinks are classified or were classified, most of them, as supplements, which meant there was no regulation in the amount of caffeine they could have in them.
Right. And some of them, particularly the ones that had the guarana, rather, should, I mean, they had, when you looked at the equivalency, it was several hundred milligrams equivalency to caffeine. So there clearly wasn't regulation on some of those substances.
Energy drinks first introduced in 1980s, market bringing in about $5 billion a year, over 200 new brands introduced in the United States since 2006. The market's leading drink accounted for almost 49% of the revenue. I think that's Red Bull is the one that has the lion's share of the market. Teens increased their energy drink consumption by 16% from 2003 to 2008. A third of teenagers regularly consume energy drinks. I had, for the first time, I had a medical student come into a lecture I was giving and sat down a can of Red Bull in order to listen to my lecture. And, you know, it's almost like the child had lit up a marijuana cigarette. Mm-hmm. To me, this stuff is, my generation, this stuff is so, it seems so unnatural that it felt very uncomfortable. Coffee, I'm fine. A lot of the students use Mountain Dew. But when that young woman brought Red Bull to a medical lecture, it really set me back. And yet, one-third of teenagers using them regularly.
Absolutely. And the little, you know, five-hour energy drinks and what I try to emphasize to teenagers is that there are very good, healthy ways to get energy. One is to go back to getting sleep, because there are lots of good reasons why. And we know that when you don't sleep well, it stresses your body. So that's one way to get more energy into your activities, is that you're getting adequate sleep, but you're also getting good nutrition. And the problem with a lot of these energy drinks is that it will give you a quick buzz, a quick rush, and then you crash. And you feel worse than you did before you started drinking the energy drink, because you really have lost this sort of stimulated high that you have. So it's much better for you, when you look at glucose and all of those sorts of things, to eat something healthy that has some protein in it. And then you don't have these big spikes in your glucose levels and your caffeine levels. And it kind of increases your energy, but it puts it on more of an even plane.
Energy drinks marketed to adolescent males, a lot of sports sponsorships, automobile racing teams, and extreme sports athletes. A study of 800 college students, 39% drank energy drinks in the past month, males more than females, and what they call jock identity was associated with the frequency of energy drink, as well as energy drink alcohol mixes. Is this a boy problem? The student I saw was a girl.
No, it's not a boy problem. It's a boy and a girl problem. And, you know, if you think about taking in caffeine and the effects that it will have, it may be more problematic for females because of their smaller body mass. And so the larger you are, the less commonly you're going to feel those smaller side effects than you might if you were smaller. And that's what I tell parents of young children, is that the younger you are, the more likely, and the smaller you are, the more likely you are to have an adverse effect from one of these medications. I mean, it is sort of a medication. It's caffeine. We actually, at one time, and probably still do, use caffeine to help stimulate the breathing of premature infants. So we know that it's a stimulant that has an effect on the body. And the other thing you need to realize is that caffeine is a diuretic. So it makes you lose fluid from your body. So if you're not drinking at least as much or double the amount of non-caffeinated fluid, then you're probably making yourself dehydrated by drinking caffeinated beverages. And a lot of times we see these kids present with headaches because they're relatively dehydrated, because they think they're getting fluids by drinking things with caffeine in them, when they're actually making themselves lose more fluid because it acts as a diuretic, or what people commonly call as a water pill. So I tell teenagers, if you're going to drink, you can drink a caffeinated beverage, but you have to drink double that amount in a non-caffeinated fluid, which should be either milk or low-fat dairy. And one thing I did want to bring up, because I said the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends low-fat dairy, not in the first 2 years of life. You need full-fat dairy in the first 2 years of life because of the development of the central nervous system. But after age two, then you can go to the low-fat variety of dairy products.
Again, to emphasize the caffeine, the diuretic portions of it, a cup of tea, about 50 milligrams of caffeine, a 12-ounce, now that's a can, cola beverage, cannot contain, by law, cannot contain more than 65 milligrams. Most of them, Coca-Cola, I think 45, Pepsi, mm-hmm. 35.
Right.
Interestingly enough, Ale-8s, which are very popular in eastern Kentucky, mm-hmm. are actually, they're around the range of Coca-Cola and actually less than a Mountain Dew. Again, compare that to Red Bull, a can of Red Bull, 154, Monster Energy, 240, that's the XXL Monster Energy, Rockstar, 160, Amp Energy Lightning, 160, Full Throttle, 144, and Wired X505, 500 milligrams of caffeine. I'm not sure about the 5-hour energy, but what you said I think is important. If you're running in the 30 milligrams of caffeine or so, and you put that in a drink, you probably are going to reach an equilibrium. I still wonder, you know, that guy that wakes up, He chugs a 5-hour energy mm-hmm. and heads out to work. I wonder how he makes it to work without wetting on his suit, because, as you said, mm-hmm. it's a very potent diuretic. And keep mm-hmm. in mind that the 5-hour energy has virtually no fluids at all. You don't have a
right.
chance there. So if you're using that before an athletic competition, you are going to run into some problems unless you work hard at hydration, even running problems actually staying on the field.
Right. Yeah, it really is just a terrible way. You know, it's a terrible approach to your fluids. And if you're an athlete, you really do need to be careful about making sure that you're optimizing your performance by limiting stimulants, limiting things that are going to have adverse effects on your cardiovascular system, which is going to impact your performance. So if you think about it, a lot of these kids are doing this to kind of enhance their performance, when actually it's probably detrimental and it hurts them more than it helps them.
A couple of things I found out for this show: although the World Anti-Doping Agency, that's WADA, removed their caffeine from their list of banned substances in 2004, they are reconsidering banning it for Olympic athletes and other athletes worldwide. The NCAA considers caffeine illegal if found in quantities in the urine that approximate 5 to 8 cups of coffee consumed in 1 hour. So you could, a couple of 5-hour mm-hmm. energies could get you in trouble with the NCAA if you are a college athlete. So, again, there are a myriad of reasons why these high-dose caffeine energy supplements are worrisome. I'll tell you one thing that bothers me is that, again, if you look at their defense, the way they marketing people defend these mm-hmm. products, they say, well, there's really not that much more than a cup of coffee. And they cite some of the extremely high caffeinated cups of mm-hmm. coffee. What's your response to that?
Well, it is. I mean, I think you just read off the list, and it really is significantly higher than the typical cup of coffee. And I don't really even recommend that teenagers and young children drink coffee. I mean, coffee in and of itself has a high enough caffeine level without exceeding that. The problem that we see folks run into as well is that they'll drink so many caffeinated colas that they will get their levels up because of the quantity. And I will tell you, for pregnant women, we actually have seen newborn infants withdraw from caffeine and have seizures in moms who have very high caffeine levels, very high caffeine use.
The American Dietetic Association posits that women of reproductive age, and these women should consume no more than 300 milligrams per day. That's 2 or 3 cups of coffee, again, because of the things that you have mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Very concerning. And I think the other thing, back to the athletes, honestly, there is no athlete on the team that says, okay, coach, I've had my cup of coffee, put me back in. So when you look at a comparison with coffee, you do not chug coffee. You do not take coffee during breaks and athletic performances. Coffee does not fit into a teenager's lifestyle like these energy drinks do. We got time for maybe one more response here. The kids that do it for academic performance, that they need that alertness for academic performance, does that seem to be common in your practice, kids that are trying to stay awake during classes and use them for that?
I will tell you that I see kids who pull, particularly college students, who pull the all-nighters, and they're trying to kind of stimulate their brains to be more alert because they've gotten inadequate sleep. And we know that as a group, college students are notoriously bad at getting adequate sleep. And most of them are still, I consider, in my purview, because many of them still do see their pediatricians until they're, you know, 20 or 21. But certainly for high school students, again, they're using stimulants to replace sleep. And the body wasn't set up to really run on stimulants. It's set up to run on adequate amounts of nutrition and adequate amounts of sleep. And so while I understand there are times, and I think you and I've probably both done this, either in college or medical school, you pull those occasional all-nighters because you might have put things off a little longer than you needed to, or you were just overburdened and you're trying to get yourself awake. To tell you how important sleep is, and you know this from working with the new young physicians, there is a limit to the amount of time that we will let young physicians take care of patients, because we feel like that for your brain function, sleep and rest is very important. And sleep and rest aren't the same things. You need to let your mind rest some. You need to let yourself sleep. And so I think when we look at, we know that your performance drops off in medicine when you've been working too many hours. I think the same goes for adolescents and college-age people. So you can't replace adequate sleep with a stimulant. You can do it for the short term, but for the long term, your body is going to recognize that it's not getting what it needs.
More on sleep stimulants and Dr. Donna Grigsby in our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Health Matters. This is the Dr. Donna Grigsby Show. I am your host, Dr. Tony Weaver. Rick Phillips, again, is on assignment in Isonville. We'll be back next week. Joining us from the University of Kentucky, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Chief of the Division of General Academic Pediatrics, is Dr. Donna Grigsby. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
Our sponsor for the last time, sleep. Remember, in the words of W.C. Fields, the best cure for insomnia is to get a lot of sleep, and we echo that sentiment. It is very important to get a lot of sleep. Now, in this fractional portion, I want to bring out something published in July in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. They looked at school-age kids, 11,000 children, in the United Kingdom Millennium Cohort Study, and they asked the moms. They said, well, are the children's bedtimes regular or irregular? What time do they go to bed? And they asked that at 3, 5, and 7 years of age. 20% of those 3-year-olds didn't have a regular bedtime, dropped down to 9% at age 5, 8% at age 7. And they found, in terms of their academic performance, the poorest test scores recorded by children who went to bed very early, very late, and by those who had inconsistent bedtimes. And it appears that at all three ages, those who had an irregular bedtime had poorer scores academically. So, again, I know I'm sort of springing this on you, Donna, but the idea of a regular bedtime seems to be a very important thing in addition to the actual number of hours sleep a person gets.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think children need structure in their lives. And so I think the children that I have seen that are the best, you know, that are the most well-rested are the ones who have that typical bedtime routine. So every night they can expect to have the same things roughly happen at the same time. And they build this bedtime routine. The wise parents build it around how do you get your child to wind down for the day and get ready to go to sleep. And so for many people, it involves the bath, sitting and reading together, or the child reading if they're old enough to themselves. And we all know that, you know, reading a book, even if we're interested in the book, can help relax you and help you get to sleep a little more easily. And there are some children that, regardless of what time you put them to bed, they're going to awaken at the same time every day. So you would think that they would adjust, and if you usually go to bed at 8, but let's say you didn't get in bed till 9 or 10 the next day, they're not necessarily going to sleep those extra 2 hours to make that up. Their bodies are programmed to wake up at the same time as much as possible. Some children are a little more flexible in their sleeping patterns, but it's difficult to say who's going to tolerate that well and who isn't. So it's important for the parents to be as consistent as possible in the bedtime routine, particularly if they're going to school the next day or they have an activity that's going to require concentration.
And there are lots of things that sabotage that. There's vacations, there's athletic trips, mm-hmm. and you get on some kind of a select team and you go to other cities and right. Gymnastics competitions and all-night church events and things like that. But as much as you can, this appears to be important to your child's development, not only the requisite number of hours, but also a regular bedtime and a regular bedtime routine. And I think, as you mentioned, starting with books at an mm-hmm. early age and getting that to be a part of the bedtime routine, hopefully that can stay up. There's something about a book. I don't know if a Kindle does this or not. I suspect that it probably does. But a book puts me to sleep about as mm-hmm. fast as anything. I found mm-hmm. this during my undergraduate years. I could take a book and I could be out in a matter of minutes. Whereas when I've got a screen in front of me, there right. just are too many things to click on. I'm way too mentally, I guess, engaged in mm-hmm. the activities. I cannot right. do it from a screen.
Well, and in young children, there is an added importance to being able to touch the book, to be able to, in the very young infants, to be able to put the book in their mouth. And you really can't do that with a tablet, or at least you probably shouldn't do that with a tablet. But there is this, you know, children learn from their senses, and it's not just their sense of sight and hearing. They learn from all their senses. So they need to touch things and taste things. And so that's why, you know, when I hand a six-month-old a book and they put it in their mouth and the parent says, oh, no, don't. That's why we give them board books, because we want them to go in their mouths, because it's another way that they experience the world. So I think having the actual book, and if you talk to a lot of people that were read to regularly as children, you have wonderful associations with the person that read to you. So it's an opportunity for parents and their children to slow down and to have some time that they can bond and that they can attach to each other. We all have stories, and it's interesting when I go to crowds and I ask about who was read to and who wasn't. If I go in a room full of medical students or people who are professionals of any sort, a lot of those folks are going to raise their hand and tell me that they were read to as children. When you go into other rooms, the number may not be quite as high. So it really does seem to make a difference in your language development, your vocabulary development, in your wonderful memories that you make with your parent or grandparent or aunt or uncle or whoever does the reading to you.
It does help with your sleep routine. And finally, you yes. just can't get that by handing your child an iPhone, no matter what you have loaded
you
it
You cannot.
With.
And the other thing I tell families is that you can't teach your child to speak sitting them in front of a video or a TV, because part of learning to speak and part of learning vocabulary and part of learning language is the give and take between that child and another person. So all of that's very important.
That's our sponsor, Sleep. Remember, the best cure for insomnia is to get a lot of sleep. Now, before we leave these energy drinks, there is one aspect of energy drinks that I am very concerned about in my population of young adults, and I know this bleeds over into pediatrics a little bit, and that is blending energy drinks with alcohol. Again, going back to those mm-hmm. young men that they're marketing to, surveys of them have shown that, one, they feel they need more energy, they need more focus and concentration. Mm-hmm. Two, they feel like they need to make up for a lack of sleep. And three, they bought energy drinks for the specific purpose of mixing them with alcohol. Mm-hmm. Survey of 10 universities in North Carolina, 1/4 of college students had consumed energy drinks mixed with alcohol in the past month. They were younger, they were white, and guess what? They were male, engaged in athletics, or members of fraternities or sororities, and there were significant consequences to that. Now, the problem is when you add a lot of caffeine to an alcoholic beverage, you feel like you know what you're doing.
Right.
It's called Health Matters Syndrome. You think you know what you're doing, and in actuality, you are about to mess up in a serious way. And
right.
And we have done that for a long time. Virtually every major disaster I have been personally involved in started off with me thinking that I knew what I was doing. The problem is you load a person up with alcohol, and you give them that thought, and things go bad pretty quickly.
Oh, I agree. And you see it in teenagers. The interesting thing is you can go to restaurants and bars and find drinks that are mixed with energy drinks. And it may make you feel differently, but it's not going to change your blood alcohol level. So legally, you may still be intoxicated. You may not feel like you're intoxicated. But if something happens and you have to have a blood alcohol test, that's going to be abnormal. And even if you felt like you could handle it legally, the police and the judge are going to tell you you were legally intoxicated. You couldn't handle it whether you thought you could or not.
Alcohol continues to impair judgment, reaction time, mm-hmm. but it happens that you are wide awake
right.
with impaired judgment and reaction time, which is a really bad combination. Again, college, we are seeing really an epidemic of this. This is the way students drink. There is a desire, first of all, to look and feel less drunk. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to feel all staggery and stumbly. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have the medicating effects of the alcohol, but still look like I know what I'm doing.
Right.
There are other people who actually think that, enough caffeine will cancel out in some way alcohol.
Right, and we know that's not true. You're wide awake and you still have impaired reaction time, you still have impaired judgment, and you may not realize that you're getting into trouble with alcohol because you have the stimulant on board that's masking some of the symptoms that would normally tell us that you've had too much alcohol. So it is very dangerous, I think.
There are some premixed caffeine alcohol products, the most famous Four Loko, and there were several press comments on this as well as an FDA investigation. But there are other brands, Max Vibe, Liquid Charge, Hardwired, Torque, Moonshot, Wide Eye, 3 a.m. Vodka. The names really tell you what they're trying to do. The FDA, November 17, 2010, warned companies that the caffeine added to their alcoholic beverage is an unsafe food additive and that further action, including seizure of their products, is possible. And the FDA still, there is some states have banned these products, some campuses have banned these products, but as of the time we go to press, to the best of my knowledge, the FDA has not taken that action of altogether banning all caffeinated alcoholic beverages. However, as parents, as people in the community, we want you to realize that these things are out there. Either the kids will mix their own, or they can get them premixed, and many young people get a very heavy load of alcohol with the caffeine, not realizing the problems they're getting themselves into.
Yeah, I agree. And it is, again, quite dangerous because it masks the symptoms of alcohol intoxication.
Now, briefly, we've got just a few minutes left in this segment and in the show. I wanted to talk some about ADHD medications and just a couple of things. First of all, U.S., 4% of the world's population, 2/3 of the world's Adderall is produced and consumed in the U.S., in 2013, the DEA approved the production of 189 tons of these products. That's over 500 milligrams for every man, woman, and child living in the U.S. 66.3% of children diagnosed with ADHD taking medications. So there is an issue, which we don't really have time to address, about
right.
whether or not how you should approach the disorder. What I wanted to really to focus on is something that you mentioned to me, that these drugs now are becoming academic performance-enhancing drugs, and many of the children diagnosed, young people diagnosed, may either be dealing or sharing with their friends.
Yeah, that's true. And I've heard several stories where teenagers their friends shared the Adderall with them to help them on a test, and they felt like it made such a big difference, and they're wondering if they don't need their own prescription. And certainly we know that stimulant medications for people who truly have ADHD are very helpful. But I always caution these other kids who take an occasional dose. The medication isn't prescribed for you. It has side effects. And there is a thing called the placebo effect. So if I gave you a plain pill and said, this is going to enhance your performance, whether or not it does actually enhance your performance, if you think it enhances it, it will. And so I caution them about the fact that you may think this helped you when in actuality it may have been your attitude toward the task that made the difference. And again, the side effects are not insignificant for these medications. So if you haven't been prescribed an ADHD medication, please don't just take one to see what it makes you feel like. It's a stimulant. It can affect your blood pressure. So it's just not a good idea to take someone else's medication of any kind, and certainly not a stimulant.
You know, in adult medicine, we had this problem with narcotics. Because they were pills, they were prescribed, they were given by a pharmacy, they were felt to be safe. And we lose 1,000 Kentuckians every year to narcotic overdoses and drug overdoses. And I get that same sense that there is this idea, well, this is something that is prescribed to a lot of kids. It must be okay. It's the side effects are probably minor.
Right. And we vary. If you look at the way we follow children that are on stimulant medications, we see them every 3 months to monitor their growth and to monitor their blood pressure because we know it's a significant risk.
Time we got left, I got just some recommendations about storing and monitoring these drugs in the home. They mentioned to designate a site in the home that's out of the way of day-to-day traffic. Bathroom, common bathroom is not a great place to store medicines, medicine cabinets also, because they may be targeted. It should not be stored with food products because of visibility, store it out of sight, and don't mix medications in the same bottle. What do you tell your ADHD kids and their parents about storing their medicines?
Many of those same things. To be cautious, if you have unknown people in your house, make sure that your medications are in a place where they wouldn't find them or they wouldn't know to look for them. If someone comes into your home, that it won't be easy for them to find those kinds of medications. That your child not carry the medications with them. That if you need a bottle for school, that there is a bottle left at school and there is a bottle left at home. If a child is living in multiple households, that you have a place for that medication in each of those households. It doesn't make sense in most cases for that child to carry that bottle of pills around. You need to have it kind of stationary in a safe place in the home.
It seems that various stimulants are with our society to stay, but certainly we have an obligation, a duty to protect our children from the adverse effects of these. I'd like to offer special thanks to our guest, Dr. Donna Grigsby, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Chief of the Division of General Academic Pediatrics, to WUKY Operations and Programming Manager John Lamagi, Morehead State Public Radio producer Asa Hosoda, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. Listen to our show. It's WMKY.org. We're on Facebook at HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters does not cure ADHD. We can relieve symptoms during our show, but once the show stops, the symptoms come back. The long-term impact of Health Matters on the youthful developing brain is not yet known. Some researchers are concerned that our show may interfere with normal brain development. Health Matters has been found to cause sudden death in children and adults with heart conditions. The American Heart Association recommends that everyone have a cardiac evaluation prior to listening to the show. Radio show abuse is a growing problem, particularly among teens and young adults. College students listen to our show when cramming for exams or pulling all-nighters. If your child listens to Health Matters, make sure he or she isn't selling our shows to his friends. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.